This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Mihailo Zekic.
Good day.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
Well, the Electoral College in America met this week and voted for Joe Biden as the next president of the United States. But Donald Trump's path to the presidency is still open. To learn more about this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this in a lot of ways, this has been a pretty rough week for President Trump's campaign. It started out even before the week began, about an hour after we posted the show last week, with the Supreme Court coming out and refusing to hear the lawsuit Texas and the Trump campaign had put together. And then just a couple days after that, the Electoral College formally elected Joe Biden to be the next president of the United States. But now, I mean, the news started to turn up a little bit by the end of the week, with the director of national intelligence coming out with a report. President Trump had requested this report that China, Russia, and Iran, all three, had intervened or interfered in the U.S. election, attempted to interfere. Now, President Trump had asked for a report on that by today, which doesn't look like it's going to happen. The director said the report's not ready, said it'll be early January before we get a full report on how these three nations tried to interfere in the election. But you've got a number of private attorneys, private investigators who are doing some really good investigative work on some of the concerning parts, especially with Dominion voting systems. Epoch Times has had a number of articles go up this week about organizations. One of the prominent one being Allied Security Operations Group did a preliminary report of Dominion voting systems in Michigan and found that they were, quote, intentionally and purposefully designed with inherent errors to create systematic flaws and influence the election results. There's also Fraud Spotters. That's another a private election watchdog that noted that counties that switched to Dominion voting systems since the last election have witnessed, on average, a 2-3% shift towards the Democratic candidate. And I guess the head of Fraud Spotters, he has qualified his statements with that. He's like, it is possible that's coincidence that just the counties that bought the new software saw the 2-3% jump compared to last election. But he said it's definitely a red flag that, like, the county's using this software.
Yeah.
And so that's what the former federal prosecutor, Sidney Powell, has been. She's really been calling on President Trump to impound every voting machine in the country and go through a full forensic analysis using that executive order I would just mention, because that executive order gives the Director of National Intelligence the power to do a full investigation on foreign election interference. And just by virtue of Dominion voting systems being headquartered in Canada would probably be enough that you could do an investigation like that. But with the connections, when you do just a little bit of digging, go a lot deeper than that.
Yeah, Sidney Powell is just not backing down at all. Every time she talks about this, she's wanting the full force of the law. She feels like the president should go all out to ensure that this is all exposed and uncovered, and that this happens as quickly as possible. The time is definitely running out for them to be able to do this. You really feel for these investigators trying to get all of this uncovered as quickly as they can, given the timetable. But the evidence really is very compelling, and it does give Donald Trump a number of options.
Right, right. Yeah, we do look at this full forensic analysis, start investigating it. I mean, we all look forward anxiously for the Director of National Intelligence report. The other angle that Epoch Times has really been hitting too is that even though Dominion voting systems, it's used in 28 U.S. states, but it's headquartered in Canada, But it's owned by Staple Street Capital in New York, and Staple Street Capital got this mysterious $400 million investment a month before the election with help from a Swiss bank, UBS Bank. And yes, at Epoch Times it did some diddle that said that when that transfer was made, there were actually three Chinese nationals that were on the board of UBS Bank who have since been scrubbed from the record. There's been people even speculating that it's almost like they just appointed these Chinese guys to the board temporarily to get the transfer done, and then tried to sweep it under the rug so no one would notice. So that's another story I'm sure we'll be hearing updates on in the days and weeks ahead, is like, especially with all the revelations of how many these 2 million communist agents and businesses and banks and governments around the world. They're like, how much of these Chinese nationals on the board of this bank that's giving all this money to the company that's running America's voting right before the election happens? Is there anything significant we should know about there?
Right. Well, as Gerald Flory wrote in that article that that we've put up on the website and been promoting quite heavily, he says, "I believe you are going to see frauds exposed like you've never even imagined." We do really encourage you to hold on to that forecast that our editor-in-chief has been making. That article, "Why Donald Trump Will Remain America's President," we'll link to that in the show notes. If you have not read that, please do so. We thank you very much for that story, Andrew. The peace deals between Israel and several Arab states have truly been groundbreaking, but the Trumpets' view of these deals, everyone is very excited about them. We look at it very differently because of the prophecies of the Bible. We have a couple of stories today that show there is another side to these deals. We're going to hear one in the second half, but first let's look at some breakthroughs in Israeli defense that do relate to these deals with Arab states. For this, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, it was revealed just this past week that Israel has been conducting over the past 2 weeks a multi-layered missile defense test. This is a situation that Israel has developed where they are trying to have a defense against any type of aerial projectile fired upon its territory. And we know about the rockets from Gaza. We know about guided munitions that Hezbollah now has from Iran. These are missiles that can be directed to a specific target. And we also know that Iran is developing ballistic missile technology, weapons that get fired into the Earth's, out of the Earth's atmosphere, and then come back down and hit a target. And what Israel has said, as they announced December 15th, is that they have conducted a test where they feel comfortable in their ability to shoot down every one of these munitions through their Iron Dome system, their David's or the Arrow system and David's sling. Basically, each one of these systems is for a different type of weapon, aerial weapon. Now, the one new thing about, well, the new technological advancement that was groundbreaking is the fact that the Iron Dome now, they said, can fire upon, shoot out of the sky cruise missiles, guided munitions. This is very important because over the past 2 years, Iran has sought to equip lots of Hezbollah's missiles with a GPS system, well, a system whereby they can hit any target in Israel. They can be directed towards a target. And Israel did not, it seemed, have a solution for that. But now Israel is announcing that the Iron Dome system has the ability to blow those guided munitions out of the sky also.
Very impressive. And Israel is really at the forefront of these technologies, these defensive technologies. An announcement this week from Israel about the possibility of sharing some of this. This is really what's of a special interest.
Yes. The head of Israel's missile defense organization, Moshe Patel, this is underneath Benny Gantz, the defense minister. He came out and said that was talking about how all these relationships that are now developing with Gulf states, that of whom they share an enemy in Iran, that there is the possibility in the future of sharing this technology. Well, he said two things. One, the fact that sharing the Iron Dome or something like that with the Gulf states is something that could be feasible in the near future. And that's because, obviously, you know, you've had the massive attack against the Saudi and UAE oil facilities. But last year, the Aramco facility, which was targeted by drones and cruise missiles, if there was an Iron Dome in the vicinity, with this with the current ability that it has, that could have stopped that attack from happening. And it looks like the tests, these tests that just took place, were designed after that Aramco facility was attacked so that Israel could deal with that a similar situation on its own territory. So that is one. The second part that he said, and I'll quote him now, this is again is Moshe Patel. From an engineering point of view, of course, there's a lot of advantage to sharing the technology. And then he said, there's information that can be shared, like sensors that can be deployed in both countries, meaning the Gulf states, because we have the same enemies. And he went on to talk about how that if there is an early warning system that is integrated with Israel, with the Gulf states, they will have a better chance at hitting such munitions from Iranian home territory. So one, it's giving the Gulf states or them buying the ability or the Iron Dome system themselves. But then the second question is will Israel be willing? And it says that the door is open for an actual integrated defense structure with the Gulf states, a sharing of technology, but also intelligence that would then allow them to fire on Iranian targets.
Now, this is interesting in light of Bible prophecy for a number of reasons. One is you see that when Israel is testing these missile defense systems successfully, you see they do have a lot of confidence that this is going to keep them safe. I think this probably gives them a certain amount of comfort level in talking about these types of things, because they feel like, well, they're pretty well protected, even if there is an aggressor foreign nation that would want to do them harm. But when you're looking at these deals and these relationships that they're building with these Arab states, in light of the prophecies of the Bible, the more you see this kind of integration or this willingness to trust in these states, it really does give you cause for alarm.
Yeah, I mean, the question is, of course, if you share enough with the Gulf states, could that be used against Israel in the future? That is the big worry. That's the big worry about the F-35 deal, obviously, to the UAE that's gone through from the United States as well. And this is something that seriously must be considered and is obviously being considered by Israel, but probably isn't given the weight that it should. And definitely considering biblical prophecy, where we know that these Gulf states in the long run, though they do share an enemy in Iran with Israel right now, in the long run, these Gulf states are part of an alliance that actually double crosses Israel. And so that's what we see right now. You were never going to see a Gulf state come and say that they are part of a military alliance with the state of Israel. But as George Friedman from Geopolitical Futures pointed out this week, any type of recognition such as what is happening between Gulf states and Israel is tantamount to a security alliance. That is what Israel is building right now. And yet the Bible says that the Gulf states, along with other moderate Arab states that are lining up to sign deals with Israel now, they are going to be the ones that attack Israel. So there is a vulnerability that Israel is opening itself up to with sharing this technology, as well as different munitions going to these states. If people want to read more about that, they can read our editor-in-chief's recent article, Mr. Gerald Flory's article. It's entitled Deadly Floor in Mideast Peace Deals.
Well, thank you for that, Brent. I'm sure we have more to talk about on that subject, and we'll just save the rest of that discussion for the second half when we look at yet another aspect of this. Now, remember the Nord Stream pipeline, this hugely important and strategic energy project between Russia and Germany. Well, this has been stalled by sanctions imposed by President Trump, but as of last week, the project is back on. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, I guess as we were recording this show last Friday, this pipeline laying project resumed. They've finally got another ship in there to lay pipes. So we're talking about this gas pipeline that exists to bring natural gas from Russia to Germany. They've already got one, and then they're building now the Nord Stream 2 to bring even more gas under the Black Sea. And America, and especially President Trump, has been a very solid opponent of this pipeline project. A lot of Eastern Europe has been a very solid opponent of this pipeline project as well. In Poland, they've apparently taken to referring to it as the Molotov-Ribbentrop pipeline after the deal between Germany and Russia that was famously made in the run-up to World War II, where they divided Poland between them. You know, they see that this is something that gives Germany access to natural gas at a very reasonable price. You know, lots of good economic opportunities. It makes them a natural gas hub for Western Europe. In exchange, it gives Russia much more precise control over natural gas flows in Eastern Europe, so that Russia can use this tool to bully the countries of Eastern Europe to cut off natural gas to specific countries, and so that they can use that as a political lever. Something that they've done in the past. They cut off quite famously Ukraine's natural gas in the middle of winter. But this allows them to do it much more precisely, cutting off one country without cutting off downstream countries from them. So President Trump opposed this. He stepped in there. He stopped it. It's been stopped for almost a year. And now it has finally started up again.
When this shut down, it seemed like they were very much in the final stages of the construction of this. How long are they now that they've decided to resume this work from actually completing the pipeline?
Yeah, this is, it could end up being a photo finish. And I guess pipeline projects don't end up being exciting races, but it looks like this could be one. So they've said that they could get this finished probably within the first quarter of the next year, or maybe more realistically that it might take about 6 months to lay just that final section of pipe. But the United States isn't just sitting back and letting Russia get on and finish this. So the NDAA law that is currently getting ready to come through to President Trump's desk contains provisions that would put enhanced sanctions on the Nord Stream pipeline. It would upgrade them. So it wouldn't just be so anybody who provides services for vessels, if you refuel a vessel that's working on the Nord Stream pipeline project, if you provide insurance for a ship working on this project, you would then become a target for U.S. sanctions. And Senator Ted Cruz and others are confident that this will shut the project down again. We'll have to wait and see on that. But it is a pretty impressive demonstration even so far that America's economic power gives it. I mean, we've talked a fair bit, especially right. on Wednesday's show, about the power China has with its economy. You know, America has a lot of power, too. It just doesn't choose to use it very often. And what happened earlier where they passed a law that said if you lay pipes for this particular pipeline, that's it. No business with the United States. We'll seize your assets. The company that was laying the pipeline said, well, we're out of here. If it's a choice between this one project and ever doing business in the United States again,
right.
we're picking the United States. And the world isn't exactly full of deep sea pipe laying ships. It took them 12 months to find another one, get it kitted out, get it over there. And like I said, you could see this new law, if President Trump approves the NDAA, which there's a lot of debate still ongoing, he's threatened to veto that. Maybe this will get shut down again. Maybe you'll get the pause button again. Maybe Russia will have to try and get some more ships or to refuel the ships that they've got going and those kind of things. But it does start to give you we've been talking a lot about the U.S. election. There are all of these ramifications all the way around the world to what we're seeing in the U.S. election right now. And we talked, like I said, a lot about China on Wednesday's show. This is going to have a massive impact for Europe. If Joe Biden were to get in, we heard from Andrew, that's not going to happen. But if in that world, Nord Stream would probably be finished. The pipelines would be lifted. It would just be a matter of months. And then we'd get to see just how significant of a shift in the balance of power in Europe this pipeline is. But as it is, it looks like they're going to keep fighting this out for several months to come.
Yeah, it's an excellent point. I think when that pipeline project was shut down after a single, basically the stroke of a pen from Donald Trump, it really did demonstrate powerfully just how influential the United States still is, in spite of all of the influence that has been squandered and lost over the last decade or more, a couple of decades. If the country really united behind a president who was willing to stand up for American interests, you just wonder how far this resurgence that has been prophesied would go. But it really is an excellent point when you look at the kind of a world that we would have in the event of a Biden presidency. It's not difficult to see how it would just rapidly shift dramatically against America's ongoing presence in the world. And just to look at this prophetically, we do see the way that Russia and Germany are coming together on this project. It shows just how determined these foes of America are to try to create this kind of post-American reality.
That's right. We've got this, and you have this situation repeatedly where a rising Germany tends to form a relationship with Russia, and Herbert W. Armstrong, going all the way back to pretty much as soon as Germany was defeated in World War II, was forecasting, well, Germany is going to rise again, based on these Bible prophecies that talk about God using Germany to correct Britain and the United States and Israel and the Middle East and other nations. So you've got those prophecies. You've got this history that these two tend to work together when Germany is rising. Then there are other prophecies that talk about trading alliances that come together, that talk about exactly the kind of power that America has demonstrated being used against America. You know, that's something, as we spend trillions on coronavirus and kind of destroy our own economy, well, that's a powerful warning there. When we cede control of the global economy to other powers, they can use the same power that America has been showing. They can use that against America. And the Bible says that is what's going to happen. But Mr. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry, he talked about this in an article, Germany and Russia's Secret War Against America. And in that article, he wrote, when they enter into peace deals and economic partnerships, talking about Russia and Germany, it's a signal that either or both are preparing for some kind of imperialistic exploit. And so he said that this makes the Nord Stream 2 deal extremely concerning. And that's what's happening here. You've got two nations that see a common interest in bringing down the United States and changing the global order. They're working together to do that, and the fact that they are working so hard on that is a powerful warning to the United States.
It certainly is. We thank you for bringing that to us, Richard. Moving on, it has been over 40 years since a space mission collected samples from the moon. That is until earlier this month. And guess which country managed to successfully complete a new moon mission? To learn about this, we'll go to Mihailo Zekic.
Late last month, China launched the Chang'e 5 probe. Chang'e is the name of a Chinese moon goddess, and that is the name of the Chinese space mission. And just this Thursday, Chang'e 5 just returned from its trip to the moon. It is the first mission to visit the moon and come back since the Soviet Union's Luna 24 mission in 1976, and it brought back with it 2 kilograms, or roughly 4.4 pounds, of lunar rocks and soil. China is so far the only country in the world to do moon missions in the 21st century. And this is a really huge mission, not just for the fact that it was the first to return. It was also the first to bring back samples in a very long time. And China even went so far as to plant a Chinese flag on the moon, made out of a special fabric to withstand the lunar elements there, which, funnily enough, America is the only country to so far put flags on the moon, and scientists estimate that all those flags would have been bleached white by now from solar radiation. So America is literally waving the white flag to China on the moon.
Yeah, there's so many, so much evidence of just how much China is advancing beyond America. This is a powerful symbol of this broader trend that we're seeing.
Oh, exactly. And it's not this is not just a one-off. The Chang'e 4 mission, the mission before this, was the first lunar mission to send anything to the dark side of the moon. The probe is still there. It didn't return, but that was still a first. And China is planning quite a few more Chang'e missions in the future. Chang'e 6 and 7 will continue to explore the moon. And China is even developing the Chang'e 8 mission, which is a probe going to be sent to explore the possibility of setting up an international moon base. And China has stated that their goal is to set up a base on the moon by 2030.
So what is China's interest in this? Is this more than just symbolic? What is the advantage of moon exploration and space in general?
Well, Chinese President Xi Jinping stated in 2013 just what the nation's aims are. He said that China's space program was, quote, a part of the dream to make China stronger, end quote. Now, for a couple of centuries now, China has been in a quagmire politically. It was taken advantage by the colonial powers during the 19th century. It was carved up by Japan in the first half of the 20th century. And in the second half of the 20th century, it was mired in internal conflict and couldn't really reach past its borders. But now, ever since the Cultural Revolution and other parts of Chinese history have ended, you have seen that China has ascended to a level that it hasn't seen in a long time, and it is trying to project its power and reclaim its status as one of the premier powers of the world. You see that with economically, like the Belt and Road Initiative. You see that with its military exploits in places like the Philippines or the Senkaku Islands in Japan. And funnily enough, Yi Pei Zhang, who is the chief commander of the Chinese Lunar Exploration Program, had this to say in 2017. The universe is like the ocean. The moon is like the Diaoyu Islands, and Mars is like Scarborough Shoals. We will be blamed by our descendants if we don't go there and others get there before us, end quote. Now, Diaoyu is the Chinese name for the Senkaku Islands, and Scarborough Shoal is an island off the coast of the Philippines that China unilaterally annexed. And so basically what he's saying is that they're out to conquer. I mean, they're out to basically colonize space. And America also has interest in this, too. Recently, President Trump has stated that he was going to send men to the moon again. He authorized the Artemis program, which hopes to send the first woman to the moon by 2024. It makes my Canadian heart flutter because it is a joint project between America and Canada, which would make Canada the second country to send people into deep space. But one has to wonder if this is a little bit too little too late.
Yeah, they're trying to catch up with China. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, America has been downscaling its space program in recent years. We haven't had a space shuttle launch in roughly a decade after the program was canceled, and we've been relying on Russia, of all countries, to get to the International Space Station. While China has been able to expand its space program tremendously, and they're even talking about a plan to launch a Chinese space station in 2022. Meanwhile, the U.S. has been the main advocate of the International Space Station, but that space station will retire later this decade, making China the only nation in control of a space station for the foreseeable future. And America sidelined China when it came to the International Space Station. It didn't give China permission to use it. And so there is a lot of speculation that China will do the same thing once it's to America, once its space station is set up, and even once its moon program is to build a station on the moon is finally up and running.
If you could just give us the overview of why we are concerned about this from a standpoint of Bible prophecy.
Of course. In the book of Revelation, you have a prophecy in chapter 16, verse 12, about a conglomeration called the Kings of the East. Chapter 9, verse 16 specifies that this group of people, this conglomeration of nations, will field a 200 million man army and is going to cause a lot of devastation. In fact, the Bible terminology for this 200 million man army is called a woe, as in a woe to all the inhabitants of the earth. And you think about it, an army like that has never been fielded ever in history. But there's really only one region that can supply it. If you look at the population of countries like China, Japan, India, it's Asia. China has over a billion people, so does India. And China is extremely aggressive and militaristic. And Bible prophecy doesn't say that China will be the one to attack America. Once this 200 million man army is assembled, it's going to really rock this world. And even if you think about the Asian empires of history, like the Mongols had an empire that stretched from Korea all the way to what is Poland today. It seems like Xi Jinping has an even bigger ambition. He wants to conquer outer space. And when you have that kind of leadership commanding such a huge army, you know that there it is not going to bode well for Earth.
Quite a story. We appreciate you bringing that to us. We've got a lot on the rise in China coming in our next Trumpet edition. Do stay tuned for that. In the meantime, you can read Mihailo's article on thetrumpet.com, One Giant Leap for China, about this moon landing. And the broader context is explained in our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy. Thanks so much for that, Mihailo. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We'll take a short break. Stick around.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Back to those Arab-Israeli peace deals. As we have mentioned on previous programs, the Arab states that are involved in these agreements with Israel are doing so out of a desire to restrain Iran. Now, this does align with Israel's interests, but the facts show that this is just about where the alignment ends. To learn more about this, we'll go back to Brenton Octagon.
Yeah, what's also, as you said, what's interesting about this is Iran is the big nation in the picture, because as these nations get closer to Israel, what's happened is that they are seen to be neglecting the Palestinian people, the Palestinian cause. And why this is important is because now, as time goes on, Iran seems to become the sole champion of the Palestinian cause. It's going to look like Iran is the nation that is willing to back up the Palestinians where they have been rejected by the Gulf states, by Egypt and others. And this is really a fascinating aspect to what we see. What are the Palestinians going to do? It used to be that all the Arab states said, and the United States pushed this dogma on the region as well, that peace with the Arabs can only happen after peace with the Palestinians. The Arabs have come along and said, well, actually, we fear Iran right now a lot, and the Palestinians have proved themselves unwilling to deal with Israel. So we're going to put the Palestinian issue aside, and we're going to deal with Israel because we need Israel's help in order to counter Iran. And so what are the Palestinians going to think? Now, up to this point, only one of the Palestinian or two of the Palestinian factions have been in bed with Iran, Hamas and also Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And both of those operate out of the Gaza Strip. Inside the West Bank, where the major bulk of the Palestinians are, Iran has always tried to insert itself into that area, but it's led by Fatah, or the Palestinian Liberation Organization, and they are not aligned with Iran as yet. They haven't been. In fact, they fear Iran because they know Iran is going to fund Hamas, and Hamas is going to want to take over the West Bank and boot out Fatah. But Fatah now, which is the head of the Palestinian Authority, is seeing their cause be sidelined by their backers, their old backers inside the Gulf. And so are they going to be pushed into the arms of Iran? And this is something that George Friedman wrote in his piece this week as well. It's entitled Arab Recognition of Israel Redefines the Middle East. And so there's a lot of moving parts, but this is one important aspect because it does align with biblical prophecy. One quote from George Friedman now. He says, Iran's counter is a serious one. The recognition process leaves the Palestinians isolated from their former allies. Iran can portray itself reasonably as the only champion of the Palestinians and the only true enemy is of Israel. The Arab states have regarded Palestine as a side issue for a long time, but the same is not always true for their citizens. Iran's move now, he's saying, he's looking to the future. Iran's move is to adopt the Palestinian cause as its own and speak to the Arab public in terms of betrayal of the Palestinians and capitulation to Israel. So we've got a lot of moving parts here, but he's seeing that what's Iran going to do? Iran's going to come out and say, hey, Palestinians, we're the only ones for you. We're the only ones that are going to fight against Israel. The Gulf leadership has deserted you. And what is the rest of the Arab street going to say?
Right.
The Arab populations of these nations, are they going to side with their own leaders in agreeing to normalize relations with Israel? Or are they going to then look to Iran for leadership for the greater cause of the liberation of a once Muslim land, such as Israel and the Holy Grail being Jerusalem? And this aligns wonderfully in terms of what the Bible says is going to happen.
Yeah, the agreements between the leaders of these Arab states and the leaders of Israel are the things that make all the headlines. But when you dig into what the view of the populace within these nations is, you get a really different picture and in some ways more important picture than what the leaders are doing.
Yeah, for sure. And there is a lot of statistics to back this point up, that there are divergent beliefs when in terms of Israel, when it comes to the leadership of these country and the people. Just a few stats. If you look at Egypt, Egypt currently has a friend and ally and Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, the strongman there. But 85% of Egyptians do not favor recognition with the state of Israel. 85%, that's a lot, and they've had a peace deal for a long time. If you're looking at Saudi Arabia, there's only 6% of Saudi Arabian citizens that would support recognition with Israel. If you look at, let's say, Jordan, which has a peace deal, 93% of the population of Jordan does not want a peace deal with Israel. And so the only way that the Jordanian and the Israeli peace deals have remained in effect is because you have strong dictatorial rule coming from the top of those countries that are disregarding the democratic will of the people. If democracy had its way in Egypt, if democracy had its way in Jordan, we would see a massive change in the foreign policy. The foreign policy that would match the will of the people, which would be antagonistic towards the state of Israel. The big question of all of these normalization deals with Israel is the leadership of the country strong enough to overcome the will of the people? Meaning, will there be revolt on the streets inside Arab capitals if they normalize with Israel? UAE is easy. It's a different. It's a different state. The UAE's, I forget what its average income of the population there, but it's absolutely massive. It's huge. It's rich. It doesn't act like the rest of the Arab street. Why hasn't Saudi Arabia acted already? Because they have a massive underclass of people that do not like Israel, and it's worried that there could be threats to their own rulership. The rulership of MBZ, if there is a peace deal. Now, this is very interesting in terms of biblical prophecy, because we do expect, the Bible says that Iran is going to champion the Palestinian cause. We've expected that. We do expect Iran to take over the Palestinian cause in the West Bank, take over that territory through its proxies. We also expect a number of Arab states that are currently okay with Israel to actually flip over to the Iranian side. And what will motivate them? George Friedman's exactly right. The Palestinian cause has been sidelined by the Arab leaders and the people are going to be upset. Some states will experience revolt. We do not expect that in the Gulf states, but we do expect that in states like Libya. We do expect that in states like Egypt. We expect Egypt to turn to be pro-Iranian going forward. And that means, it seems, that that the leader there probably is going to be removed at some point in the future.
It is a fascinating subject. If you'd like to know more about it, Brent has an article up at Watch Jerusalem. Trump's Middle East peace deals are just getting started. And we'd also like to point you to our trend article, Why the Trumpet Watches Iran Allying with Egypt. Both of those articles will be available at the show notes for today's program. Thank you very much for that, Brent. The former Soviet state of Uzbekistan made a move this week that brings it closer into the Russian orbit that it had declared independence from. For this, we'll go back to Mihailo Zekic.
On December 11th, Uzbekistan was welcomed as a new observer member of the Eurasian Economic Union, or the EAEU. The current full membership of the EAEU includes Russia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Armenia, and Kyrgyzstan. All of these countries are, of course, former members of the Soviet Union, as was Uzbekistan, and looks like Uzbekistan is going to join their ranks. Now, the EAEU was founded in 2014 as a single market, similar to how the EU functions. They function as one giant economic bloc. Currently, it's limited to trade, but plans are under discussion to set up a common currency for the bloc, as well as a Eurasian central bank. It already has a union-wide Supreme Court and a Eurasian Economic Commission, a governmental body patterned after the European Commission. Now, what's interesting is Uzbekistan, like a lot of former Soviet countries, has been mired in political corruption and leaders overstaying their terms. Recently, they got rid of their strongman that has been in power since Soviet times, named President Islam Karimov, who was one of these holdover government officials from Gorbachev. And he recently exited the picture in Uzbekistan, and in came Shavkat Mirziyoyev, who was seen as a reformer. People have compared him to Gorbachev in Uzbekistan, bringing political reforms to a very corrupt country. And so some people are a little bit surprised that he decided to turn to Russia now, but he has stated that he hopes to make to integrate Uzbekistan fully into the EAEU, and their plans to do so by 2025.
So yeah, you look at the membership in this union, and it's starting to look a whole lot like the Soviet Union. The fact that Uzbekistan would be coming in and joining as an observer in this union, it is kind of rebuilding the USSR, isn't it?
Oh, totally. This would not be a small addition to the union. The Uzbeks were the third biggest ethnic group in the Soviet Union after Russia and Ukraine, and the country currently has over 33 million people. And so it would be huge if Russian President Vladimir Putin could bring them in. In 2005, Putin said that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century, and everything he's done so far has been to bring that union back. And the EAEU is basically his version of a modern version of the Soviet Union, based off of the European Union model, to make it look a little bit less oppressive.
Right. So, prophetically speaking, help us to see why this is critical.
Well, in Ezekiel 38, verses 1 to 2, we're introduced to an interesting figure called the Prince of Rosh. The scripture mentions him controlling places like Meshach and Tubal, and the trumpet editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, in his booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, ties this man to being Vladimir Putin. He identifies Rosh with the ancient identity of Russia, Meshach as the identity of ancient identity of Moscow, and Tubal as the ancient identity of Tobolsk, which used to be a major Russian city in Siberia. And he wrote in the booklet, quote, The use of all three names shows that this is an individual ruler of all the peoples of Russia from west to east. The reference to the cities of Moscow and Tobolsk help us see how vast Russian territory is in these latter days. And this is the key part. This giant swathe of land indicates the prince will probably conquer more nations of the former Soviet Union, end quote. And while Putin at this point isn't conquering Uzbekistan militarily per se, you could see him trying to snag what was this once key component of the USSR back into the fold.
The Prophesied Prince of Russia is the booklet. We will link to that in the show notes for today's program. Thank you very much for that, Mihailo. It is in no small part because of Putin's activities working to extend Russia's influence and even its borders that Europe is continually trying to expand its military capabilities. The latest example of this comes from Sweden. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, on Tuesday, Sweden approved their defense budget for the year 2021 to 2025, and they approved a huge 40% increase in this budget. This is the biggest hike in the Swedish defense budget for 70 years. It brings that budget to a total of $10 billion. That's peanuts compared to America's budget, I guess, but it's still pretty big for Sweden. And this comes from, well, this comes alongside plans to grow the armed forces. There's, they've got about 55,000 different positions within the armed forces. They want to grow that to 90,000. By 2030, so we're talking about some very significant increases, and this is a pattern for Sweden. This is not the only thing by any means. In December 2017, for example, they established a new military regiment for the first time since World War II. Another important decision that also came this week was that they decided that the parliament expressed their readiness to join NATO as a possible option. So it's one of those things where Sweden has joined the EU but kept out of NATO, while Norway has been in NATO, kept out of the EU. But they're looking at changing that, something that obviously NATO's been around for a long time and they've not done that. So a lot of significant steps that we're seeing showing Sweden is very concerned about the overall condition of the world.
Well, of all of the threats that Sweden is looking at, how much do you feel like it is Russia that is causing this kind of this decision to increase its budget?
Yeah, a pretty large extent. I mean, it's not a coincidence that both our Europe stories this week come from the Baltic. You know, as Russia expands in this area, it makes other Baltic countries nervous. And we're seeing new stories about that. So, for example, this was on December 7th, so I guess a bit over a week ago, Russia announced that they were going to form a new motor rifle division within the Army Corps of its Baltic fleet. And other bits of they've been steadily increasing their military presence in that little enclave of Kaliningrad there on the Baltic coast. So it is a large degree in response to that. And even Sweden a few years ago produced educational leaflets about, well, what to do in case of a massive cyber attack. And again, who's the big state actor that's been doing cyber attacks around the Baltic countries? Well, that's Russia. So a lot of that's to do with Russia. Sweden also does have a big problem with radical Islam. And it would not surprise me if radical Islam does play a role in some of the thinking and the instability in the Middle East. And with so much energy coming from the Middle East, anything going on there is going to impact other countries, even if they're like Sweden and quite a long ways away and have some alternative sources of energy. So that, I think, would play a role as well. But this really is a trend that we're seeing all across Europe. It's not just Sweden. We have seen in the last 10 years or so, in country after country, this trend of cutting budgets after the end of the Cold War turn around and countries start spending more. And this is something that we have forecast and expected for quite a long time. We have a trends article titled "Europe: Why the Trumpet Watches Europe's Push Towards a Unified Military." And this talks about exactly why we forecast this. I mean, I mentioned in the first half there are all these Bible prophecies about God raising up Assyria in order to punish America, and a lot of these prophecies draw attention to the military aspect of this power that is rising in Europe, led by Germany. You have got prophecies in Revelation chapter 17 being one of the most obvious that talk about this 10-nation combine that arises. It gives us enough details that we can see quite clearly it's referring to a European power. It's a power that rises and falls repeatedly, that's led by a church. There's not really many countries that you or locations you can point to that. But it talks about it being a conquering power, a military power. Lots of other prophecies in the Bible talk about it having a military power. And so we are expecting this to happen in Europe. You can see this happen in Europe. So that article, Why the Trumpet Watches, Europe's Push Towards a Unified Military, will help you take you through all of those prophecies, help you prove for yourself that this is something forecast in the Bible, and that when you're seeing stories like this, you are watching Bible prophecy fulfilled.
Well, thank you very much, Richard. The peaceful transfer of power has been a hallmark of America's success throughout its history. Well, this latest election threatens to be a very different story. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, America really is in a bit of a precarious situation right now, with pretty much no matter what happens in the days and weeks going forward, having large percentages of the population going to think that this election was fraudulently stolen. Lynn Wood is a prominent attorney who's been filing lawsuits for the Trump administration. He filed one big one jointly with Sidney Powell, who we talked about earlier in the program, that was thrown out of court. And right after over the weekend, before the Electoral College met to elect Biden, but after the Supreme Court had thrown out the Texas lawsuit, he seemed a bit disheartened at the chances that this the voter fraud was going to be exposed. Even posting on Twitter, he said, "It's better to be safe than sorry. Make sure you have plenty of water, food, flashlights, batteries, candles, radio, Second Amendment supplies, and a plan to meet with the leaders of your communities. Remember, we only have one president at a time. Our leader is real Donald Trump, not Biden." And I guess all our American listeners are well familiar with the Second Amendment. For any of our international listeners, it's part of the Bill of Rights to the U.S. Constitution. It's the Second Amendment to the Constitution, which, paraphrasing it, states the well-organized militia being vital to the security of any free society, the right to the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
Right.
And so when he's saying Second Amendment supplies, he's talking about the right of the people to keep and bear arms. So this is like guns, ammunition. Basically, the reason the amendment was in there is that, like, if a foreign power or a domestic tyrant or someone tried to, like, illegally seize control of the nation, people had the power to resist that. And so that's kind of the context of this statement. He figures, like, if the election's been hacked and the new administration's been compromised by Chinese agents, it's like people need to start taking some drastic measures to protect themselves. And we've got an article on our website right now that I wrote. It's entitled "Prominent Election Attorney Stock Up on Guns and Ammunition," and it covers what happened, and then cites a statistic from the CEO of Smith & Wesson, that's a prominent gun company, saying that 40% of their sales this year have been to first-time buyers, people who aren't like hobby skeet shooters or hunters or something like that, people who are getting a gun for the very first time because they're concerned. But then it also goes through prophecies. I guess the one we'll highlight on the radio program is in Ezekiel 5, talking about just how much Lynn Wood has underestimated the threat. There's these prophecies in Ezekiel 5 talking about civil war and trade siege in America, and talking about like a third of the population dying. So that's about 110 million people. So that's something more intense than the Revolutionary War was, as intense as that was. And it's not something that a gun's going to offer you much protection from.
Right.
It's the type of thing you're going to need divine protection from. That article I just mentioned also includes a link to the book Jordan and God's Church in Prophecy, which we can put in the show notes, that delves deeper into God's plan to protect those who look to him and him alone for protection.
you know, it's interesting. He's forecasting a scenario where Joe Biden is president and people have to be armed to protect themselves from the government under a Biden administration. In some ways, I think the scenario with a Trump victory ultimately is just as, if not more, dangerous. And you see the kind of violence that you expect, that you could see erupting in American streets, to be even worse when the left feels like the election was stolen from them. Well, we will link to those articles in the show notes. We thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, Mihailo Zekic, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Henry Ford: obstacles are those frightful things you see when you take your eyes off your goal. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.